Well, despite the convictions and jailing of Wa Lone and Chor So U, there is no doubt that the massacre they uncovered of 10 Rohingya men at Indin village on the 2nd of September 2017 did take place. As well as field evidence, Reuters used satellite imagery to assemble and verify the events surrounding the murders. Satellite imagery has been used widely to help verify testimony that Myanmar's government has engaged in what the UN calls a textbook case of ethnic cleansing. So just how important is it, and other high-tech options like drones and big data and social media analysis? Well, Joshua Lyons does just that sort of high-tech data collection and analysis for the global rights group Human Rights Watch. He's currently in Australia on a speaking tour, and he joined me in the studio prior to the decisions in the cases of Wa Lone and Chor So U.
The traditional investigative method for collecting primary information and evidence about major violations of human rights law and international humanitarian law, the Geneva Conventions, is with quite low-tech traditional methods, deploying people into the field to meet with witnesses, survivors, and even if possible, to meet with and take testimony from the actual perpetrators of these crimes. And this is done with the larger objective of exposing that material and advocating for change, for accountability for the perpetrators and justice for the victims. But there are obviously many fundamental challenges and limitations to that low-tech, field-based testimony approach to the documentation of these abuses. The most obvious one is that how do you conduct your investigation? How do you gather that information when the government is denying you access, or when the rebel forces have denied you safe passage through their territory, or when it's simply physically too dangerous to investigate on the ground, or it's impassable because of the roads and bridges have been washed away? So that those pose quite obvious physical restrictions on that methodology. And then more broadly, when you have collected testimony, how do you verify the veracity of that material? How do you establish the accuracy? What happens when the testimony appears to contradict itself or contradict other testimony that you've gathered? How do you evaluate limited and incomplete testimony in relationship to a much broader pattern of abuses? And more challenging still, even when you have established the veracity of that testimony, how do you communicate that to a public that's increasingly suspicious and cynical about testimony? And how do you communicate that and convince governments to act on that evidence when they are increasingly hostile and dismiss evidence-based reports out of hand as fake news? And so those are really the fundamental challenges, and that's exactly why the new technologies are so exciting. It's not just about satellite sensors, but also includes now drones, quantitative big data analytical methods, computer learning, machine learning, artificial intelligence, three-dimensional modeling for the purposes of verifying and analyzing social media. All of these and many more technical developments within the last 10 or 15 years have really transformed the way in which human rights investigators can conduct their work, precisely because the technology allows us to compensate and overcome those traditional low-tech barriers to the investigative method. And let me give you a few examples. Obviously, the satellite imagery, weather permitting, is able to observe effectively any place on the surface of the Earth on a daily basis. And that gives us an incredibly powerful way in which we can overcome those traditional and historic barriers to investigations on the ground. We can look beyond the wall or the security checkpoint to see what's happening in areas that are physically denied to us. And it also gives us an ability to look at a much broader area that an investigative team, even if they have access on the ground, would not be able to survey in the time frame that they have allotted. So we can look at hundreds of square kilometers of of impacted villages, for example, and combine that with the testimony at a later stage. There's also this very interesting historic component to it. It's a sort of a virtual time machine, where before we are even aware of the allegations of these crimes, we have an ability then to go back in time and look at the archival satellite imagery that's been maintained by the commercial data providers, and see what were the events on the ground that led up to that crime.
Can I just stop you there, because it'd be good, I think, on that specific point of using satellite imagery and that capacity to go back in time, to refer to a particular example. And I think Myanmar is a very good case of that, isn't it? Human Rights Watch released earlier this year imagery showing villages had been bulldozed in areas that had been depopulated of the Rohingya people. That's a case in point, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. The most recent application of the satellite imagery in the context of the crimes against humanity committed in Rakhine State was the documentation of a new government strategy of bulldozing and demolishing previously burned Rohingya villages. The official position for this policy was to prepare for the resettlement of the Rohingya people who had fled into Bangladesh across the border. But a more critical interpretation of that demolition is that it is also accomplishing the act of destruction of physical and forensic evidence that exists in these villages to this day. We know that it's highly probable that the demolition that we documented with the satellite imagery was resulting in the physical removal of extensive human remains, as well as critical forensic evidence that would be used to establish the means and methods by which the villages were destroyed. No one physically had access to those locations. Now, we hear about it. We see reports from the government, but we have no independent ability to verify that on the ground. And that's exactly why the satellite imagery has a critical role in providing an independent monitoring mechanism for human rights investigators, for the United Nations, for example.
There's another example I'm interested to hear your explanation of, I suppose, which is a case in Mosul in Iraq, after it was retaken from the Islamic State group and Iraqi security forces were in the city alleged to be committing abuses. Can you describe for me what you did in that case?
In that particular case, we had access to a particular video that had been uploaded to social media showing Iraqi government forces arbitrarily executing and dumping bodies into a river. And the critical challenge, obviously, was to try and verify it, to establish the authenticity and the date and the time. In many of these cases, there is a fundamental verification challenge, because we know in point of fact that multiple actors are deliberately and maliciously leaking fake videos. On top of that, many people who are trying their best to document it on the ground mistakenly give wrong material. So there's a huge burden to establish the locations and veracity. And so in this particular case, We had this video. It was very, very striking. And the challenge in this case was to try and identify landmarks and very unique features that we could establish and identify from the video frames and match those to precise locations within Mosul. Without knowing anything more, this process could have taken many days or weeks, or very likely resulted in no determination. The key part of this was having a researcher in Human Rights Watch on the ground who was able then to quickly show the video to other people who were familiar with that, with Mosul and in the alleged location. And very quickly, within a matter of minutes, we had very precise recommendations of where to look. And it was that interaction between the people on the ground and myself remotely that allowed us to then identify the exact physical locations. And that proved to be a critical step toward establishing the veracity of the film, of which then was publicized and led, I believe, to significant investigations about those summary executions.
I want to ask you in a moment about the results you've gained by using these technologies, but I also just want to talk about drones a little bit, because I know you're using those as well. I mean, what's their particular value to your investigations?
Well, the drones are very exciting precisely because they provide capabilities that the satellites simply do not have. And that, more broadly, that's really why governments and militaries develop the drone technology precisely to overcome their own limitations with their own spy satellites. The drones in particular, they have this unique ability to fly underneath clouds, and so it overcomes the primary barrier to using satellite-based observation systems. They're fundamentally limited by weather, except for very exotic radar satellites that are really intended for different purposes. The drones allow us to record video. They allow us to see levels and of detail on the ground and human events and activities that you could never accomplish with a satellite, for example. But the drones obviously come with many significant challenges that the satellites do not pose. For the drone technology that Human Rights Watch is in possession of and uses in the field, as well as the same drone technology that UN investigators and other international agencies now use, it's very small. These are handheld, hand-launched devices, and that means you have to be very close to the area that you want to document, to observe. And that raises a multitude of security questions. And then on top of that, there's also the very, very critical question about privacy and security for the people who have been themselves imaged. In a particular case in Lebanon, I did use a drone to document an extensive health crisis related to the unregulated and uncontrolled burning of garbage across the country in Lebanon. And in one particular case, when we were flying very close to a border, the drone was shot at repeatedly, and when I went to recover the drone, one of the armed men confronted me and was extremely agitated and very clearly thought that I was very likely to be some foreign spy. Now, that resolved itself peacefully, but it could have ended very badly. Mm. And that was a research mission that was done with the complete permission, not only of the Lebanese government, but with explicit operational permission from the Lebanese military authorities, who had given us a document, which is probably why I'm here to speak with you now today. The risk for other volunteers and for other investigators, let's say, in using the drone technologies, they do not necessarily have those types of permission. And so there is an associated risk of large numbers of very motivated but poorly trained and limited in their institutional support to do this type of drone work in humanitarian natural disaster contexts or in complex emergencies. And you think, for example, in the earthquake in Nepal, or in the emergency response for Vanuatu, or in the Philippines most recently, there were large numbers of well-intentioned volunteers who went into the field who had no real humanitarian field experience, and they tried their very best to collect vast amounts of imagery to support first aid responders and immediate emergency response. But the images that they've collected were in many ways an impediment to that larger humanitarian response for different reasons. In Nepal, it caused a significant backlash by the government, who responded out of security concerns to restrict that activity. And there was really no oversight on the part of the UN to regulate and to control the data that was being collected. And we feel very strongly that there's a profound privacy component to what drones can collect that needs to be carefully considered by the larger humanitarian community. In many cases, the images that we document from a drone have a very powerful ability to identify things that people would reasonably expect to be private. Okay, we can see things in their backyard. We can identify their clothing. We can see behavior in locations and in times when they do not believe and would never reasonably believe that they would be observed in that way. Mm. And so the data itself has to be treated very differently.
What about the effectiveness? Do you see governments, authorities responding positively, if you like, to your advocacy now that you're using these sorts of techniques?
Very early on, when we started to combine the traditional testimony with satellite imagery, for example, seemingly more independent and scientific, that put them off guard. And in many cases, the government's response was to basically accept it. Now, that didn't necessarily translate into meaningful action on their part, but they did not tend to dismiss it outright because it seemed patently absurd to do so. Now, I think, unfortunately, that period has gone, and now what we see in point of fact is that many governments feel quite adept at releasing their own satellite imagery or drone imagery or imagery acquired from military helicopters, and then misrepresenting what that imagery actually shows. And then it becomes essentially a debate between a government and a non-governmental organization about the interpretation of imagery.
So technology is no magic fix for solving the world's human rights issues then?
It is an effective technique on the part of governments to produce misleading interpretations of their own imagery-based material. I think that does have some impact, but it does not intrinsically change the reality that the evidence that we have collected and interpreted is still evidence that will have a meaningful legal value in a criminal proceeding should it reach that stage.
Joshua Lyons, very good of you to join us. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Joshua Lyons is a satellite imagery analyst for Human Rights Watch.